Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. At participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
Believe it or not, turkey season is going to be here before we know it, and my favorite piece of turkey gear last season was the Meleagris turkey vest from XOP. It's got tons of storage for all my calls, extra shells, decoy stakes, and even a bird bag pouch to stuff a long beard in for easy carrying back to the truck. On top of that, I know you all had some gear that didn't work quite as well as you would have liked this last fall, so go check out some of the stands, sticks, and harnesses that they've got as well. You know my picks are the retrograde stand, the X2 sticks, and the super minimalist holiday harness. Go build your kit today at xopoutdoors.com. If you've listened to this show for a while, you know that if there's one tool I absolutely cannot live without, it's the Onyx Hunt app. I use Onyx year-round to mark spots, find new properties, access landowner information, and so much more. But throughout the year, I tend to use the app differently depending on what I'm doing. Right now, I'm always using it to double-check stream bank easements in the driftless, and when I'm not doing that, I'm using the slope angle layer to look for pinch points or little knobs that a buck might be betting on. And of course, when I'm in the field scouting, the tracker feature is running at all times to paint a picture of how things move throughout a property. To learn more about all the other features that Onyx offers, head over to onyxmaps.com. We all know there's nothing worse than being cold and wet while you're trying to pursue your favorite game. That's why I trust Huntworth with all my hunting outerwear needs. This past fall was the warmest and driest I've ever been throughout an entire hunting season, and that's all thanks to Huntworth's Heat Boost technology and the DWR waterproof finish on their clothing. I've been wearing the Durham lightweight pants almost every time I hit the field, whether I'm chasing whitetails, busting brush for pheasants, or doing some postseason scouting, and you'd better believe that these things will be my go-to for turkey season as well, thanks to the waterproof seat and knee panels paired with the lightweight, breathable body. I'll probably rock the Grayling hoodie for the early season and eventually transition to the Fallon lightweight shirt when the hot late season starts, and all that's going to be in their Tarnan pattern, which I have absolutely fallen in love with over this past year. Go build your kit today at huntworthgear.com or visit the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're doing well. I hope you're enjoying this, You see the beams, the fall spring. I'm hoping it's not a fall spring. Looking at the forecast, it looks pretty good. It has felt good to get outside, though, after a nasty stomach bug that kept me laid up for pretty much like a week, which was just terrible. So I hope that hasn't made its way into your house. And I hope that you've been outside finding some sheds, doing some fishing, having some fun, just enjoying the little taste of spring we got going on here. But you've probably seen, if you're a social media connoisseur, that there's a lot going on in the space around public lands. We've seen a lot of stuff happen with the Department of Government Efficiency making some cuts recently, and a lot of people really just finding themselves with a lot of questions about what's actually going on, how it affects them, and how it affects hunting, fishing opportunities, as well as public land. And so I had a chance to sit down with the one and only Sam Soholt, the owner and founder of Public Land Tees, and just all around outstanding dude and conservationist, photographer, you name it. And I just wanted to pick Sam's brain about what the heck's going on. And I had an outstanding conversation with him just about that. What is going on in our outdoor space, especially at a federal level? How is it affecting us? And how can we as outdoorsmen and women interpret what all is going on right here and not succumb to the outrage of you know, social media and that kind of stuff that we tend to see, and instead take a step back and really take a look at what's going on here and seeing what should be on our radar and what's, quite frank, I don't know, I hesitate to say clickbait, but what's, you know, out there kind of with a title designed to get us boiling the pot a little bit. You know, we, as Sam puts it in our conversation, you don't want to boil the water without having something to cook in it, you know, right? And so Sam does an awesome job of just laying all that out for us in a super easy to follow, non-alarmist way. And I learned a ton from this. It left me feeling like, okay, I actually do know what's going on here. And I'm hoping that's going to leave you the same way as well. But Sam tells us a little bit about his early days. We talk a little bit about the current state of outdoor media and entering that space. If that's something that, if you're a young guy listening and you want to get into the space, he's dropped some tips there. And then we wrap things up with, of course, I couldn't let him off the line without asking him a little bit about his photography, and we get the rundown of what lenses are in his bag and which ones he uses most throughout a year. So I'm gonna wrap this one up. I've got an afternoon to myself here, and so I'm gonna go do some freaking shed hunting. Enjoy this conversation with Sam. Huge thanks to him for coming on the show. Go check out publiclandtees.com. Get yourself some sweet swag. It all goes to protecting our public lands. And with that, enjoy the episode. All right, 3, 2, 1. Joining me on this week's episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman, I've got Sam Sohold on the line. Sam, how are we doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Excellent, man. I'm excited to have you on. After just learning about your, I guess we'll throw them under the bus, that Vortex was the culprit of your torn Achilles and all that. I didn't realize that happened so close to home for us, but we're glad that it's on the up and up and that you're recovering quickly here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long process, but it was, yeah, of all the places it could have happened, I guess doing handgun drills at the Vortex facility, it's not terrible. It was, yeah, it sucks that it happened, but hey, I'm already 8 months post-op, so I'm like, you know, about 4 months away from being back to like 100%.
There we go.
It's all good. It's just time and effort.
Yep.
Like everything.
Exactly. Well, that last 10% too, that's the longest building process to get back to too.
For sure.
So that'll be... I don't know. I'm sure climbing up hills, chasing turkeys is going to be a great way of rehabbing that ankle. And
That'll be huge.
Therapeutic, if anything, right?
Yeah. Rehab through activity. That's what they tell me.
Exactly. I like it, man. Well, dude, I wanted to have you on just given the light of kind of the conservation space right now. A lot of folks have been seeing stuff in the news here just on whether it be Fish and Wildlife employees getting cut and everything, and just impacts that's going to have on the public land space. We've all heard of some of the Western states looking at, well, I think it was Utah, right? That kind of had that push to try and acquire their own BLM lands and then kind of
basically trying to steal 18 and a half million acres of our land.
Right. Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And so I wanted to have you on, man, because you are a guy who, you're a very public-facing figure here, well-connected in the outdoor space and everything. You've got your own, brand, Public Land Tees, that really is, correct me if I'm wrong here, designed specifically kind of to just raise awareness and support for public land. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yep.
Awesome, man.
That was the whole goal with it.
I love it. And so that's really why I wanted to have you on, is because that was coming up on 10 years ago now that first happened. And obviously the landscape's changed a little bit, and it's also, there's some things that kind of have persisted here. And so I wanted to get kind of just your take on, you know, what was going on back then and what's going on kind of on the horizon for right now and everything. But before we dive into that, can you tell folks a little bit about where you're from, kind of just how you got started in the outdoor space? And I mean, you've worked with, I'm sure, everyone's favorite brand and hunter at some point or another, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, no, I grew up in the Dakotas, grew up in South Dakota, and then chose to go to North Dakota State University based on proximity to good duck hunting. And it was just a way to stay on the Great Plains and chase ducks and geese and pheasants and deer. And but yeah, grew up kind of on the flatlands, and then got an undergrad and a master's in business, but had a strong interest growing up in, the photo video side of things, but really had no idea what I was doing. And then ended up turning that into I got an internship with Midwest Whitetail and which was fun because it basically was being thrown into the fire where I was having to either hunt, film, or edit, you know, every single day for like 90 days. And in the moment, like, obviously, you know, it's a ton of work to do all that stuff, but it was so much fun. Like, and, you know, ever since then, like, that kind of like go hard in the fall mentality has been definitely ingrained in my blood. So got the internship there. And then I moved to Colorado to work with my brother, who had opened up a archery pro shop and backcountry hunting store, and did a bunch of like YouTube style videos for their shop. And then that led me to a job in Montana, where I was a sales rep for about a year. And then that kind of fell through, and I jumped right back into photo video stuff and started filming. And it's, you know, I look back on all this stuff, and it's always like the small decisions, that lead to the biggest changes. Mm-hmm. The fact that like I was a sales rep and I happened to be working at a coffee shop in town in Bozeman, overheard a guy talking on the phone about finishing up some video project. And so after he was off the phone, he was at the table next to me, and I was like, hey, what, you know, just struck up a conversation. And that was what led to getting hired to go film a bear hunt in Alaska, which then led to getting hired on and going and filming for the Weather Channel for Coast Guard Alaska on Kodiak Island. Did that for 3.5 months. And then that job led to meeting people from the History Channel, and I filmed a bear hunting show for 30 days on Kodiak. And then that job led to meeting somebody who hired me for my first ever professional photo shoot. And so just like, just every single job led to, you know, like a little bit of networking just led to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And, you know, all of a sudden that snowball gets pretty big. And as that network grows, you know, the number of emails and calls and follow-ups and stuff, kind of escalates. And as that pipeline gets opened up, all of a sudden you got more work than you can handle. And, lucky for me, I just got to shoot photos and video stuff all over the country and world and do that for kind of a, you know, pretty solid chunk of time from roughly 2013 until, did that for like 3.5 years, and then kind of started to transition into doing a lot more of my own type of, you know, my own hunts and creating content surrounding that. Which then led to the bus project, which was a way to create a billboard to raise awareness about public lands, and which then led into Public Land Tees, and then everything we've done over the last since, you know, August 2017 was when we launched the website and got all that going. And since then, we've raised several $100,000 to give back to different organizations for all sorts of different projects. So it's, that's a very succinct, you know, version of my timeline, but didn't want to spend too much time going through the whole story, because I tend to talk way too long when it.
No, not at all, man. Stuff. I mean, I've got so many questions already just from that. There was bunch of stuff in there that I had no idea that you were, you know, doing stuff in Alaska for that long or anything like that. I mean, the first thing that jumps out to me too is, you know, with your experience with, Midwest whitetail, 90 days, just running and gunning, burning the candle at both ends. That's got to be kind of like a trial by fire sort of industry experience, right? Where it's like, if you can handle this, you can probably handle doing things on your own schedule or, you know, stuff like that. What did that, what were some of the biggest constraints or things that you had to, or biggest hurdles, I guess, that you had kind of had to overcome just getting into the space and, you know, kind of getting the hang of things there?
Yeah. You know, I feel very fortunate that I came, like, I was my age at the time of all this stuff that was happening. I got lucky in that, because, you know, now like the platforms and stuff are very saturated with people who can shoot a great photo or a video or whatever. And so being kind of at the forefront, like of Midwest whitetail, you know, they had only been, I was there for the fall of 2011. And I believe they started in 2008 or 2009. So it was a very fresh, you know, website, and it was growing. And, but what had happened was the fall before, so fall of 2010, I had picked up a bow, had shot all summer, and, was all fired up about season. And, you know, season rolls around. I hunted, you know, like for, you know, every weekend pretty much that I could, trying to kill a deer. Well, November finally rolled around, the rut happens, and I shot, you know, a little 2x3, you know, a little forky thing, you know, on November 10th. And then on November 18th, I shot like a low 130s 10 point. And so I am like cloud nine, over the moon, jacked up. Think I'm an absolute, you know, stud when it comes to archery whitetail hunting now. Mm-hmm. But what that led me to do was I literally cold called, cold emailed any contact I could find at any of the hunting shows. I was emailing like info at Outdoor Channel, but I was like sending my resume and hey, just looking for opportunities, you know. And earlier in the fall, a buddy of mine had sent me a link to one of the Midwest whitetail videos. It was, I don't know if anybody listening to this might remember it, but Larry Zach, who's a wildlife artist, he had shot like 193 inch, like just mammoth of a deer. And my buddy had sent me the link to that video. And I, in the midst of this like mass email, you know, campaign, I had remembered that I had got that link. And so I was like, oh, I wonder if they ever need interns, you know? So I emailed whatever the email contact was at Midwest Whitetail. And Bill got back to me like 3 hours later and was like, hey, we're always looking for interns. If you have time, why don't you come down over Christmas break? And, at the time I was in my fifth year of college and I still had another summer and then fall of like online courses to finish up my master's. And so I was able to do the internship and only had one like class to finish up while I was down there. But he's like, yeah, come down over Christmas break. We'll interview you. So I drove from North Dakota home to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then made the trip down to Albia, Iowa, and showed up at the shop. And I hopped in Bill's truck, and we went to Subway and grabbed a sandwich, and then went back to the shop and talked for like 20 minutes. And he's like, all right, well, we'll let you know. And so and that was it. You know, so I had driven 6.5 hours from Sioux Falls down to Albia and met for 20 minutes, and then you know, kind of made my way back home. And, but then I heard back and I was like, hey, you got the internship. So I went down there in June and met all of the other guys that were going to be working there and all the brands that were sponsors of the show. And then a lot of like the pro staff guys, mm-hmm. which was really cool. And then I went down in early August and started working on everything, you know, and at that point I had a really nice camera. I had a, prosumer video camera that I didn't really know how to use. But all the guys that were there were like as nerdy as I was about like trying different things and trying to learn how to shoot, you know, creative stuff and like, mm-hmm. you know, looking up to, you know, being inspired by, you know, the guys at Heartland Bowhunter and different, you know, shows that at the time that were doing really cool things. And then trying to recreate that with the tools that we had. I mean, we were doing stuff like building gimbals and cranes and stuff out of just random, you know, a bucket full of sand and, you know, 1x2s and whatever, you know, just a bunch of random stuff. And like to get these shots that you might not be able to get, you know, if you were just doing handheld. So, but the biggest things I learned at Midwest Whitetail was it was one, I had lots of deadlines, right? So I had a weekly show that I edited, but I was managing the pro staff for two states. So it was, I was managing the pro staff for Michigan and Minnesota, and it's all volunteer pro staff. So I had to learn how to squeeze footage out of all these volunteers who have mm-hmm. their own lives and doing all their own things. So trying to manage people and really help them understand like, hey, I know you might be only doing this like one day a week, if that, but when you're out there, if you could possibly like get this list of shots, like, you know, and then try to sew that into some sort of storyline. Mm-hmm. You know, one fun tidbit about that fall is as the editor of the Michigan show, they went an entire season and they killed two bucks, neither of which was with a bow and neither of which was in Michigan. So it was a rough fall of editing for me.
Right.
Yeah, it was just a lot of, a lot of time watching, you know, sunsets and sunrises that people are sending me and different stuff. But it was fun. I learned a ton. And it's for anybody who has been an intern or was an intern, you know, it really was like a farm league for people to go kind of do what they wanted to in the industry. Mm-hmm. Because it was like anybody who was looking to hire is like, well, they have a skill set, you know, everything from blog articles to video editing to storytelling to photography to video, you know, like it's a very highly sought after skill set in marketing departments across industries. So it's been cool to watch, like, where everybody that I worked with and what they're doing now, and everybody who was after us, and what they're all up to. It's been fun.
Yeah, definitely, man. That's super cool, man. What an awesome experience. And
yeah,
you know, I'm curious too, you know, you mentioned that it's kind of like a farm league and stuff. Given today's, I don't want to get too far off track here, but I got to ask, given like today's, just, I mean, the landscape of things with social media and people, you can make your own YouTube channel in 20 minutes and, you know, be online, all that kind of stuff. Do you still think those internships are, I guess, do you still think it's kind of like a farm league sort of thing? Or do you think
the
power has kind of been dispersed?
Yeah, as far as like a stepping stone, like you're getting your foot in the door, I think those internships are amazing. You know, especially like what the Hunting Public guys do with their interns. Because it's like a vetting process, because if they get a good intern, you know, guys like Nick Andrews and, you know, like Brett Walker was there last year. We're hiring him for some stuff this spring. You know, it's like a, like, I know that we can hire people like that and trust that, you know, they're going to be able to do a good job. And I can call people that, you know, I can call Warb or text Warb or, text people who work with the Hunting Public and be like, hey, give me a rundown on, you know, the interns from this year. Like, you know, are the guys worth hiring? How they do, you know, and like, it's a very simple process because, you know, you can trust them because they, I mean, you talk about going through the ringer. Like, I turkey hunted with Hunting Public guys for a whole spring and it is next level insane. Like the pace and, just the lack of sleep that those guys run on. I don't know how to do it. It's a very cool, like, team bond that they have. I don't think I would survive as part of that team. But being able to hire guys that have gone through that ringer, or, you know, that do work for, you know, the Breaking Point or Midwest Whitetail or whatever the internship might be, I think it gives you a step up on the competition. Because without it, when you start your own thing from scratch, trying to get noticed or trying to get to the point where people trust what you're doing, it's just a lot harder path to get your foot in the door.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely, man. That's super interesting. I was going to say, do you have any advice for any young folks who are thinking about maybe trying to do an internship or anything like that? Anything that they might be able to do to, I don't know, get their foot in the door with those, some of those groups, or whether or not, I mean.
Yeah, I would say, you know, start your own thing, or like be shooting, be editing, be, you know, learn how to tell stories. You know, there's a lot of assets out there now that you don't even have to read a book anymore to figure all those things out. You can go to YouTube University and, you know, learn all of those different things that I just said. And so I think having kind of a little portfolio, you know, even if it's super rough, but just showing the initiative, like that, okay, for the last year, you know, I put out a video every single week, you know, of the things that I was up to in the woods and on the water or whatever. Like just showing that track record of being diligent enough to like self-police and get things done like that. I think stuff like that can go a really long way when it comes to trying to get those internships. Cause you can be like, yeah, I've already been doing this for, you know, 12, 18, 24 months.
Right.
When you send in that resume. And again, even if it's super rough, if you're just, you know, Mr. Beast said it best. He's like, nobody's going to watch your first video. Nobody's going to watch your first 100 videos. He's like, if you just create 100 videos and try to get just a percentage better every single time and, you know, fix something, tweak something, do something a little different, tell a different story. By the end of that, you're going to know, you know, 1,000 times more than someone who spent a year trying to create one perfect video.
Right.
So I think just being consistent with content is one of the biggest differentiators between people who have that leg up and people who are just kind of like out there doing it as a hobby.
Absolutely. That's a great tip, man. And so true. Cause like, I mean, like you said, everybody's first video, I mean, shoot, my first podcast, terrible, dude. Horrible. Yeah. That's really great. Yeah. I mean, especially just working with brands and stuff too, you know, that's great advice. Just build that consistency to show that you're willing to put in the time and all that. So that they know that you're serious about it. You're not just somebody who's trying to get on the fast track or do whatever.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. All right, so switching gears here to our public lands talk. When did, I guess, let's rewind here to the start of public land tees and everything. So what kind of inspired that? What was going on back in, it was 2016 or 2017?
Yep, 2016.
2016, that kind of just, I guess, was the call that you felt you needed to answer.
Yeah, well, it's funny because a lot of the things that were happening in 2016, it's a lot of deja vu currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in for one reason or another, there was a kind of a play back in 2016 that was more or less like a marketing play. And it was, they were bundling this nice little thing of federal transfer of public lands to the states as a states' rights issue. Mm-hmm. And what that means is they kept saying, like, well, the states are better served to manage these lands because it's their, you know, it's state, it's land that's in their state. They have better access to, you know, get people on those lands. They can make decisions based on, you know, weather, drought, all of the different factors that go into it. And we think that the states can do a better job of taking care of these public lands. And that's all great. I love states' rights. I would much rather have a much smaller federal government, like a much smaller government in general. I think we all deserve to have as much freedom as possible, as long as we're not acting like a bunch of idiots. Mm-hmm. And the thing with federally managed public lands is that because there is so much of it, if it gets transferred to the states, so at the federal level, it does not have to be a money-making asset. Like the lands are held in public trust, held by the people. So you, me, everybody listening to this is a public land owner. And that's because we all pay taxes. And it is the government's job to actually manage these lands based on our wishes. We want to have lands that are open and free to use for multi-use. And that's everything from hiking, camping, biking, hunting, fishing, you know, you name it, any outdoor recreation. We want lots of space to be able to go do this. Well, what happens when that land gets transferred to the state has to make money on it because they have to have a balanced budget or a surplus in their budget. They can't run all of these millions of acres of land at a deficit. So what happens is the majority of the time that states have been given public land or gifted land at statehood, most of them have sold off all that public land. And then the other thing is a lot of places that have state land, they lease it for different uses, you know, whether that's grazing rights or mineral rights or you name it, a bunch of stuff. Well, then it goes to the person leasing that land has the rights to either have it, leave it open or close it. And so you, a lot of times you'll have large chunks of state owned land that are closed to, you know, shooting, closed to hunting, closed to hiking. It's basically then like private land at that point.
Right.
And so federal land transfer is just a fast track to privatization of our nation's public lands. And so that was the big, like, kind of tipping point of, in at least in my mind, that it was like, well, can't stand for that. So let's see how much noise we can make. And there, you know, at the time, you know, I was pretty late to the game. There was a lot of organizations and people that were talking about all this stuff, but it was the bus idea had been kind of floating around for a while, but it was finally like the right storyline for that billboard of like this gigantic 36-foot rolling, you know, thing. Like, okay, now it gives us something to actually talk about and something to, you know, have a mission or a goal behind it rather than just some dude out in a school bus that's hunting and fishing. Mm-hmm. And so now, like, we're seeing a lot of the same types of things. So since then, you know, kind of the landscape, what happened was there was this big push or this, you know, kind of talk of transferring the lands. Well, then we all got real mad, you know, like across the country, hunters and fishers kind of united. And it was like, honestly, one of the first times I've seen like the hunting and fishing community actually like step up and reach out to their representatives, reach out to their senators and say, hey, like, this is a no-go. Like, this is something that we can't stand for. You need to vote against whatever bills might be, you know, forcing this to happen. And organizations like BHA did a great job of recruiting kind of the younger crowd. But across the board, I mean, it was MDF, RMEF, Pheasants Forever, you name it. Everybody was talking about how important and vital our public land system is. And I think that one of the other things is people need to understand is like, we have, the rest of the world doesn't have public lands. Like we right. are a very special case, like in the world, when it comes to national parks, national forests, BLM, because of our national parks, like the rest of the world has national parks. So I think people need to understand like that, like there's places that are worth protecting and places that are worth not completely decimating. Now, we can't be naive enough to believe that we can't have some extraction. We have like, you know, in order to progress, there's things that we have to do. But there are ways that we can do that without completely ruining the landscape. So I think what we're seeing now is that, unfortunately, the administrations, both left and right, the pendulum, because it's the extreme on both sides, right? The pendulum swings one way. And when over the last 4 years, you know, so 8 years ago, the pendulum started to swing way to one way. And that was massive deregulation, a push towards kind of stripping back a lot of those protections, things that we had fought hard leading up to that point to put in place. And then what happens? In spite of all that, it's the pendulum swings the other way and it goes too far the other direction. So what you end up having is preservation a lot of the time instead of conservation. So conservation is using, improving, maintaining, and creating a better landscape, whether that's habitat, some, you know, extraction off the land, things that need to be done that continue to, that land continues to evolve, but it's always trending in the right direction. Preservation is simply locking up that land. Nobody can do anything on it. You might be able to recreate on it, but like there's no, it's no multi-use, which our nation's public lands were set up to be multi-use, other than national parks, where those are more of like a preserve type thing.
Right.
So I think what we're witnessing is just like, now the pendulum is going the other way. And so it's mm-hmm. just like this constant Band-Aid ripoff. And most of us are sitting here like, there has to be a middle ground that we need to get to at some point. And that, you know, like, I hate to go off on all these tangents, but what happens is like, okay, when they tried to transfer federal lands last time, it was basically just like, okay, we're just going to transfer them. Well, then we fought against that. Well, then it starts to get real murky. And what happens is, in order to kind of make that happen down the road, they start to play different tricks. And so there's defunding of, you know, management tactics. You know, there's a backlog of however many millions or billions of dollars on the national park system that of maintenance stuff that needs to be done. And the people that we have elected, both like for the last, you know, 20 years, have not done the job that needs to be done in order to have all of those lands managed they need the way they need to be. And that includes, you know, fire mitigation and stuff. You know, one small example, when the administration paused all of the funding to all, you know, basically federal grants, and it was only like 24 hours. Well, what happens is if a project that has been in the works for 3 years, the funding gets paused for even a day, well, then all of a sudden you got to go through that process again to kind of like, it's not like, oh, it just picks back up. So there was one project, I think it was in California, but it was this massive fire mitigation. And so they had spent the whole year before basically cutting and pulling all of the fuel like into piles to then burn off the landscape during the winter. And so that way you have these fire breaks and different things on this, like, you know, 2,500 acres or whatever. Well, because of the pause in funding, that all gets shifted back and then you miss the window of time when you can burn. So now you just have a whole bunch of burn piles that are sitting out there waiting for a lightning strike to completely light up the entire landscape instead of being managed and burned off the land. So that's one example, but that is nationwide across the board. A lot of that funding, you know, because it got paused, all of a sudden there's these projects that will never get done because of that little lapse in timing.
That's wild, man. I had no idea I think everybody, you know, myself included here, obviously, you know, you think, okay, they're going to pause. And then it's like, you think of it like a faucet, you just turn it on and off and it picks right back up where it was going. But no, like,
yeah. Well, I think people need to remember like how slow, you know, the wheels of government turn.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you've got like forward momentum, you kind of got to keep it moving forward, because if it comes to that grinding halt, like trying to get that repaired and back, you know, into the pipeline is a nightmare, you know. And then on top of that, you know, and I'm trying to be very mindful right now, because in 2016, 17, you know, we all had a tendency to like any little thing, we would all like get way too fired up a lot of times, and then, you know, things wouldn't really happen.
Yeah.
Or it would happen differently than it like originally had been, you know, some article would come out and then 3 days later, there'd be like a follow-up to that where there actually was a plan and it was not really something to get too worked up about in the first place.
Right.
And so this time around, I'm trying to be a lot more patient, and kind of read through some of the news. Like, understandably, there's a lot of very angry people right now. But I, you know, anger only goes so far. I think we need to figure out like what the actual plan is. If there's not a plan, we should definitely be worried. But, you know, I think there's things that need to be done in all industries that we need to figure out how to more efficiently use the funds that we are getting to manage all of these places. Now, I am not in favor of just basically taking a chainsaw to, you know, this whole landscape and letting go a whole bunch of people that should have been let go, and maybe holding people that should have been let go. You know, right now I think we're witnessing, you know, a sledgehammer tactic when we need a scalpel, to go in and remove some, you know, and to find actual things that are maybe waste, things that are, that need to be funded. And the most frustrating part to me is that we have elected these people in place that we believe are going to manage these things on our behalf. Like, and obviously there's some people that are, you know, anti-public land and would love to see it all sold off. And most of those people have interest in big oil or big gas or, you know, whatever it might be. So, but yeah, and like, I was talking to my brother who's co-owner of Public Land Tees, just about how to navigate the current public land landscape. And there's a lot of things that need to be talked about. But we're trying to do what we've always done and wait for, a little bit clearer picture and see if there's actual legislation, coming down the pipeline that we can actually rally people behind. Because right, just boiling the water when you don't have anything to cook, doesn't help anybody, because people get really tired of it really fast. And, you know, I watched that a few times on different issues in the past where we kind of, you know, started burning that forge a little too hot too soon, mm-hmm, and people get bored and move on to the next thing. Well, then when the bill actually comes down, well, then you're trying to like drag people to the finish line to like actually, you know, call a representative or send an email or do whatever. And, yeah, there's a lot of things right now I think that people need to be, just kind of staying in touch with. There's good organizations like Howl.org. They do a great job of keeping everybody informed on different bills and, things that are happening. Sign up for the newsletters, you know, Sportsman's Alliance, BHA, any, whatever your passion is. Like, I guarantee there's a newsletter. You know, if that's the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, if it's, mountain goats, if it's wild sheep, if it's whatever, I guarantee there's a newsletter through those organizations you can sign up for free, and they will send you mostly weekly news about what's happening across the landscape. You know, there's still a lot of good stuff that's happening. All those organizations are still working every single day to put boots on the ground and do things that are, in favor of habitat. I think the next step is just trying to make sure that like we don't completely go upside down, on a federal level and like start to degrade these lands too much. So I think another thought that I've had a lot lately is, all right, well, it's now time for all of us individuals to actually step up and like start. Let's look for volunteer opportunities. You know, is there a trail that you and a group of buddies can go clear because your local ranger got fired? Is there a, you know, is there a fence pulling project? Is there a habitat project where you can walk around and lay down seed, you know, or, you know, like there's a lot of these opportunities that I think will pop up over the next 6, 12, 18 months. And I think it's time for all of us citizens to step up and start to, you know, rather than just expect that the government and all the people who are employed in all these positions to be doing all this stuff. I think it's time for us to lend a hand and help out and kind of show that all of these lands are good things. And
yeah,
it's okay to pay for things, even if it's not making money.
Right.
Like these are things that the value of goes so far beyond monetary value that it's not even funny. And anybody who's ever spent a morning in the woods or in the mountains watching the sunrise can tell you that. So
definitely, man. Josh, I wish that had just been said on like NPR, so it reached like the people who need to hear it the most. Aside, like the last thing I want to do is like create an echo chamber, because like people who listen to the show are obviously, you know, we're folks who are barely more, you know, engaged and aware of like the stuff that's going on. And yeah, I mean, dude, you painted a beautiful picture of just the current landscape and what everything. The major issues and everything. It kind of seems like, you know, when the pendulum swings, like you said, one way, it's all right, we got to fight to hold on to our public lands. And then it swings the other way. And then it's like, all right, now we got to fight to hold on to our like hunting opportunities and stuff like that. And
yeah,
you know, everyone's always swinging back and forth. And like you said, you know, it's the, I mean, unfortunately it seems like given our, I don't know, our modern attention spans, like everybody so gets short. Angry. Everybody, yep, you know, does whatever on social media and shares their posts and makes their stand or whatever. And then when it comes time to actually do something about it, they've either forgotten about it or, you know, they're concerned about whatever the next thing is, whatever. So, you know, that's, I mean, that was awesome. That was a really, really great explanation of just everything and the current landscape here. And it's got me wondering too, you know, you mentioned opportunities like, you know, if your ranger got fired, getting a group of buddies together to go clean trails or pick up trash or, just do stuff, you know, locally. But how much, just given the speed at which government moves, which we all know is slow, how much is it, I guess, does a lot of this work fall on the shoulders of maybe some of like the more nonprofit, private organizations like Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or like, you know, your TU chapter, your, you know, Ducks Unlimited, all that kind of stuff? Like how big of a role do you think they're going to be playing during this kind of stuff?
You know, it's hard to tell because typically that's not like the mission of those organizations. Mm-hmm. It's not to say they don't do some of that stuff, but it's typically the mission. A lot of those is habitat work, right?
Sure.
So you have habitat groups and you have advocacy groups. And so advocacy groups, you know, like BHA is an advocacy group. You know, the money goes towards lobbying against or for bills in Congress. RMEF does both, but like a lot of what RMEF does is habitat work. And so,
sure.
I don't know how much of that will end up falling on the shoulders of those organizations, but I think it's a big opportunity for those organizations to create entirely new wings of their business where it's like, this is just spitting ideas, but like if it's RMEF, you know, maybe you spool up like a part of the organization where you are really rallying like your regional and your state chapters and whatever. And you're putting together lists of like volunteer opportunities for people to go do these things that are now being neglected. And so I don't know how that's all going to shake out. But one thing I wanted to say too is what we're watching is it's all reactive. And what's really made me frustrated about that is we've watched this time and time again, like the public land fight, the habitat fight, all of these things. It's not new. I mean, there's books from the early 1900s that it's the same thing. Guys have been trying to sell off public lands, trying to get rid of them. And it's just been this back and forth for over 100 years. And every time it's a reaction. And I don't think I'm the guy, you know, to rally the troops to do this, but I wish we could figure out a way to start. I wish we could figure out a way to kind of, you know, have an organization for the organizations kind of thing.
Sure.
Where it's like an umbrella where we start to put together a framework of what we would like to see as far as like habitat and public land management going forward. And all of a sudden you've got, let's say it's 250,000 members of RMEF, you know, however many members of PF, however many members of the National Deer Association, like all of that falls under that umbrella. And you start to push information to all of those members. So then you're talking to, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 million people at a time. And it's like, okay, here's the framework of how we could actually make this work. Here's the funding mechanisms that we would need to put in place to have all of these backlogs taken care of, all of this things taken care of. And this needs to come from hunting, fishing, and like the outdoor space, because outdoor recreation is, you know, one of the number one users of our public lands.
Right.
But to rather than just like, you know, somebody from Utah bringing a bill that's trying to steal, you know, 18 million acres, rather than just seeing that happen, then reacting, getting everybody fired up, sending a bunch of emails, start to build a framework of like, okay, this is what the next 100 years needs to look like. These are the laws that we need to pass in order to have the funding to manage these things. These are the number of people that need to be working on the landscape to actually do the jobs that need to be done. And actually start putting that into a forward-facing effort instead of constantly being on our heels all the time.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that I would like to see from these organizations is a little bit more collaboration. And so when they send a lobbyist to Congress and they stand on the floor of the Senate or the floor of the House of Representatives or talk to senators, they can say, I'm here on behalf of 4 million people who all have the same vision for our nation's public lands. And obviously there's a lot of nuance there, right? There's
right.
A lot of people have different ideas about how things should be and need to be managed. But if we can get on the same page where we would attempt to follow our North American model of conservation and start to, again, forward-facing framework on all of these things, I think in 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to look back on that and say, well, that was a good idea to start putting these things into place because, you know, now we have clean water and air and we've got less erosion, you know, because we actually added wetlands back in along these river corridors. And we have, you know, thriving populations of waterfowl because the entirety of the prairie pothole region didn't get drain tiled under. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't lose 7 million acres to fire because we burned, you know, 5,000 small fires over the course of 15 years. That, to me, seems like what we should be doing. And so I think when people see the news and see people reacting to these different things that are happening, maybe when you call or email your representative or your senator about these things, maybe start to kind of pitch some of those ideas like, hey, when, please, can we have a forward-facing framework on how to manage our nation's public lands? So that way, whoever gets elected into office can't derail the entire thing that, you know, the other administration went the way too far the opposite
right.
way. So it's, I think most of us are in this, like, you know, I think a lot of us are fiscally conservative and environmentally liberal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fairly good place to be. It's just if we could get the people who we are supposed to be watching out for all this stuff to be on the same page, that would be a dream.
Right. Yeah. It would be too easy at that
too
point.
Too easy.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I'm sure everyone's seen Mark Kenyon's posts and everything from, you know, I'm blanking on the name of that book, but all of, you know, his stuff basically about how outdoorsmen feel like they don't have a table to sit at, really. They feel like they're kind of on, I got a foot on either side of the aisle, and they're just kind of stuck, not really sure what to do here. And, you know, in terms of that, you know, forward facing, national level thing, you know, it kind of reminds me, like, Wisconsin, we're one of, I want to say, 9 states in the entire country that has a conservation Congress, where basically each county, or at least each district, has a representative. They do hearings every single year to talk about, you know, everybody can come voice their opinions on, different, I mean, whether it be regulations for hunting, fishing, stuff they want to see, all that kind of stuff. I'd love to see that reach a national scale. And then, you know, maybe that's a step towards that unified, forward facing, organization there. But that's a great distinction too, that you made, though, about, you know, just because you have, you know, you do your Ducks Unlimited, you do your Trout Unlimited, you do your all your annual memberships and stuff like that. Awesome for habitat, but the advocacy side of things needs its attention as well. And dude, I forgot how simple BHA makes it to actually like contact your local representative. Dude, like, I was like, so folks who don't know this, if you go to the Take Action tab, you select your state and it's already got the bills that are being heard, or that are on the table, I guess. And you click on the one that you're passionate about. There is a pre-written email to your representative. You can still vet it. You can tweak it. You can do whatever you want. All you have to do is put in your name, home address, I think, and like your phone number, something like that. Like, it is unbelievably simple, and you don't have to go through the whole rigmarole of, looking up your local representative and, oh, I called the wrong one, or I wasn't sure which one was actually my rep and stuff like that. Like, it's unbelievably simple to do this stuff now. Like, it's never been easier.
And at the national level, when people receive an email or a phone call or whatever, they know they have, they've done the data or whatever. They know that there's 1,000 people above and beyond that are thinking the same thing.
Right.
So it's a very simple step for you to get involved. Join an organization, send some emails, or make some phone calls. Phone calls are the best because you can just leave a message, be very civil about it, but just explain to them. You can read it off the email, basically. Be like,
yeah, true.
I am a sportsman from Wisconsin. I'm a sportsman from North Dakota. You know, wherever you are, be like, I am in favor of Bill, House Bill 805 or whatever it is, or I'm against this because it degrades our nation's public lands or degrades the habitat along river corridors, or it, strips protections for clean air and water. That, whatever it might be, you can literally read it from the script that Howell puts together, that BHA puts together, and just list that off. Like, tell a story, leave a long message, tell a story about why it's so important to you. Those things extrapolated out, it makes a huge difference when they know that they're getting contacted about one issue or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's the volume is always less than people actually think. I think everybody, we talk to other outdoorsmen and women, and we're all talking about the same stuff. We're all in agreement. We all have these stances. So few people actually take the next step and reach out and contact people. We had a guy on from one of the conservation congressmen for Wisconsin here, and he said one of his buddies was that he used to duck hunt with was a state representative, and he said if we were contacted 10 times, whether it be email or phone call, if we got 10 people to reach out, that was a lot. So it doesn't take a ton to actually like push these things through. It just like takes the initiative to actually do it. So I'll be curious too to see, you touched on, the other side of, folks who use our public lands. A lot of folks have been kicking around this idea of a backpack tax or the kayak tax or whatever they're wanting to do. And I'd be very curious to see that actually come to fruition and see how much, that's the tough thing, right? It's like, we all want the same thing, but we just want it for different reasons. And so, getting that implemented is...
The original backpack tax, I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s is when they were originally trying to pass it. And then the Outdoor Alliance or the Outdoor I don't know, it's one of the organizations that still exists, but they actually formed to fight against the backpack tax, which is mind-blowing to me. You know, and then you'll, the one of the big problems that I have heard, and it makes me like kind of shake my head a little bit, is because the outdoor recreation side of things is so much bigger than hunting, people are worried that if let's organizations like the North Face or Patagonia or whatever, if they're the ones that are footing, you know, however many millions of dollars a year in taxes, which gets passed on to the consumer anyway, but if they're having to write a check for these initiatives, just like the Pittman-Robertson Act does on guns and ammo and all that stuff, that they would have, people are worried that they would have too big of a voice when it comes to issues surrounding hunting and fishing. And so, you know, cause they might speak out against hunting and fishing.
Sure.
Or hunting, you know, and shooting. And yeah. So I think maybe, you know, one of the right paths forward there would be to, okay, how do we figure out how to ensure that hunting and fishing is legal in perpetuity? Like, how do we get that passed? How do we protect our hunting rights nationwide in perpetuity? And then we push for the backpack tax. And so that way, all of these things that need to be funded are being funded. And it's not just coming out of the pockets of people who go buy guns and ammo and arrows and bows and handguns and fishing equipment. Because we're, you know, definitely footing the bill on a lot of the things that are, you know, that make accessing the outdoors easier. And so just to basically kind of ensure, like, you know, have an insurance policy against anything happening or, you know, having hunting rights taken away, you know, maybe that's the correct step forward where it's like, okay, let's work on a nationwide, I mean, which is not an easy thing to do, but let's work on a nationwide to protect hunting and fishing rights. And then we start to, you know, add this in, but
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think that's steps one and two there of that forward facing,
that's right.
Plan there. I love it. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And that's another thing too. It's just, I mean, it's so easy to overlook how massive that other side of outdoor recreation is. Like mm-hmm. you factor in, I mean, bicycles, rock climbing stuff, you know, canoe paddles and, you know, stand up paddle boards. I mean, walking into an REI, pick something and just, you know, know that it's that whatever you buy in there is going to benefit public lands or go towards public lands. Like I have a hard time believing that like people wouldn't like can't in their heart get on board with that. You know what I mean?
Right. It's, and I understand it from a manufacturing standpoint because, you know, that's how like the gun industry works. The manufacturer has to pay it. You know, I think it's 10% on guns, 11% on handguns, or the other way around, 11% on guns, 10% on handguns, whatever. And so I think, you know, it's giant amounts of money. Yeah. And so I understand from a manufacturing standpoint that you're trying to keep as much profit as possible, but I also work in the hunting and fishing industry, and I have seen a lot of like the margins on clothing, especially clothing, like when you look at like hiking, attire and high technical clothing. So the margins are there. Obviously I think a lot of that would probably end up getting passed to the consumer. And so your prices would go up a bit. But again, if it's another, even if it was 5%, on a, you know, $700 Arc'teryx, you know, rain jacket.
Right.
Like, I don't think if the education was there, we're like, prices are going up. This is why, you know, where it's like, okay, $1 billion a year is getting funneled into forest management and, you know, improving the landscape and improving habitat and, making sure that there's, you know, sage grouse don't go extinct and, you know, all of these different things that need to happen. I don't think anybody would have a hard time with that. At least I wouldn't. I mean, I spend enough money as it is on gear, I don't really care anymore. I just, if I need it, whatever it costs, I'm going to figure out how to make it happen.
Right. Yeah. I think we all find ourselves in that boat, especially as the season approaches, or worst case scenario, mid season when something's just not working. But
yeah.
And I mean, you know, on top of it too, you're between, you know, Dingle Johnson and Pittman Robertson, and, you know, like the money's already allocated towards specific types of habitat. And so doing the same thing, I mean, I can't imagine skiers and snowboarders wouldn't get on board with, you know, more money going towards protecting their mountains and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like everybody can get behind it there. So, I don't know, man, it's simple, but it's not right.
Yeah. You want it to be more simple than it is, but it's a tough line to walk. You know, just because it is on such a massive scale.
Yeah.
But it's going to be an interesting landscape. It's going to get way weirder before it gets better. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a very interesting landscape over the next little while, just to kind of see what all shakes out and what happens.
Right. Definitely. And you just, you know, like you said, not letting the pot boil without something to cook.
Exactly.
Right? And you're not getting bent out of shape over this state did that and this state's wanting to do this and that sort of stuff. Like just stay on track, stay focused. And,
as far as I know, and I could be wrong here, but as far as I know, there isn't any current legislation that is being worked through the system to actually get rid of public land at the moment.
Right.
So far the worst thing that has happened is they laid off, you know, however many employees it was at the National Forests and National Parks and BLM. And like I said, I don't know. It would have been nice if they had stepped forward and said, listen, as we work our way through the budget and as we try to figure out how to save money on some of these things, we are having to let go this percentage of the workforce, but we're hiring back X number of seasonal employees to fill in all of these jobs that need to get done, you know, because then they don't have to pay benefits, but all of the work still gets done, even though it is seasonal. Now, I don't think that, I mean, having any sort of a plan would have been nicer than like, just like flip the switch, fire all these people, and then just watch the chaos ensue. Maybe that'll happen sometime where they'll actually let us know on what they're thinking. But until that happens, I guess we're just kind of riding out, and we'll stay diligent on watching and kind of trying to educate on what bills or legislation might actually be brewing. If there is, you know, anything that starts to come down the pipeline where it's, you know, going to lead to a transfer of land or whatever, you better believe that, like, you know, the torches and pitchforks are coming out across the nation, and there's going to be the rallies that you've seen right now, like at the Capitals and stuff, just based on, you know, the laying off of X percentage of the workforce. It'll be like something you've never seen if it's actually leads to losing a bunch of this public land that we all love and love to explore. And it'll be pretty wild if that all comes to fruition.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. Yeah. Hopefully it doesn't come to that, but if it does, we'll be ready, I suppose.
Yeah, and exactly. Folks, that's all we can do at this point is just stay in the loop. You know, there's a lot of Randy Newberg does a great job of informing people.
Yes.
Mark Kenyon does a great job of informing people. Cal, you know, from Meat Eater, he does the weekly kind of roundup, does a lot of talking about that. But again, you know, sign up for newsletters. Howell does a great job. Sportsman's Alliance does a great job. All of the, you know, niche groups, like, you know, depending on what animal you love the most, sign up. All of them have a newsletter about what's happening in Congress, NWTF, you know, you name it. So that's the best advice I can give right now, is just like try to stay as informed as you possibly can, so that when it is time to speak up and reach out, you know, you'll be ready.
Absolutely, man. And so it was BHA, Howell, and Sportsman's Alliance were the three advocacy groups that folks should get involved with that you mentioned earlier, correct?
Yep, for sure.
Three. Yep, got it. And also, I'll use this opportunity as a shameless plug to tune in next week when we're going to be dropping our first public land policy update for the state of Wisconsin here with our Wisconsin BHA policy board member, Paul Shekelman. So tune in for that next week. That's going to be an awesome conversation, just kind of laying the groundwork of what's going on in Wisconsin and what basically just how things work, kind of laying the groundwork. We're going to do quarterly updates going forward here to keep you guys in the loop with that. But Sam, as we wrap this up here, what's on the horizon for you and Public Land Tees?
That's a good question. there's definitely some things we need to do to kind of revamp the brand a little bit. Just as we've gotten, lives get busy, and, you know, sometimes websites take a backseat to, you know, raising children and that kind of thing. So I think on the horizon is, I've had dreams to do a lot more collaboration with organizations like conservation groups, you know, doing member drives and that kind of thing. So I think we'll probably try to do a fair bit more of that. I've also wanted to do some bigger, like, habitat style projects where it's like, okay, you know, raising an X number of dollars for, you know, whatever the project is, and putting an actual goal out there. We'll definitely figure out a way to do Stamp It Forward again this year. See what that looks like. I think the biggest thing is just, speaking of forward facing, is just we're trying to create a roadmap right now of what, how to move forward with Public Land Tees and how to actually, you know, get people re-engaged and kind of fired up again, and just kind of in the wait and ready to go when the time comes. So we're working through all that stuff, but obviously new designs and all that kind of stuff happening from us. But the biggest thing is working with different groups to actually move the needle a little bit when it comes to habitat and access, and protecting that access.
Fantastic, man. I love it. And folks, if you haven't checked out publiclandtees.com, definitely go do that. There's some awesome, dude, did you make all those designs? Are those all your,
Josh and I come up with all the designs, and then we've worked with like 6 or 7 different graphic guys over the years, to kind of bring them to life. Cause some of them that I can do on my own, a lot of them, like, you know, we dream up and then we have to have somebody else bring them to the paper.
Sure.
Cause yeah, it's just, we're not, I'm not graphically talented enough to make it happen. I can do simple stuff on Photoshop, but I'm not an artist.
Gotcha. Well, man, they're awesome designs. So folks, definitely go check those out, whether it be getting yourself a t-shirt or a hoodie or some stickers or something like that. And just stay in the know there. Sam, before we wrap up here, I would be kicking myself if I didn't ask you I'm going to consolidate this into one camera question, slash photography question. What lenses are in your bag this year, and what are you using them for?
All right. So, I'll do you one better. I'll do what my go-to kit is.
Perfect.
Like, basically every time I go into the field, I might add or subtract, you know, here and there, but my go-to kit is, I typically have just one body. If I'm hunting, if I'm on a photo shoot, I'll do two bodies, but my kit lens, or my lens kit, is a workhorse lens. So I typically run either a 24-70 or a 24-105, something that gives you a decent wide angle, but gives you a little bit of range. Mm-hmm. And then I go above and below that. So I always have a 70-200, which is just a great range for a lot of stuff. I can punch in a lot of things, and a lot of the new cameras, if you have a full frame, you can cut down a crop sensor and kind of push that zoom in a little bit. And then on the other side, I have a 15-35. I used to carry just a prime 14mm all the time as my wide lens, but having that little bit of zoom from 15-35 is a pretty sweet kind of setup. So, those are the three lenses that, like, take 98% of the photos. And then I have a, you know, kind of a smattering of other stuff. I've got a real long telephoto lens that I just got a 200-800, to kind of bring some of that stuff in, which I'm super excited about.
That's a Canon. Then,
like, I like taking macro shots and kind of messing around with that. So 100mm macro I rarely use it, but man, like, you can get some creative stuff with that. So
hell yeah. I love it, man. That's awesome. Well, dude, I've learned a ton through this conversation. Really enjoyed learning more about you and I could pick your brain about some of those old Midwest whitetail days. For an entire episode, I bet. But man, I appreciate a ton just you taking the time to come on the show and shed this light on kind of just the current state of all things public lands and kind of just helping paint a picture of what direction things need to head for the betterment of all of us here going forward. So I really appreciate you coming on, man. Before we wrap up, can you tell folks where the best places to, I mean, you've got a lot of stuff going on, man. Can you tell folks where to go to find Public Land Tees? Mm-hmm. You've got an awesome photography tutorial series coming out on YouTube, and also just where folks can go to find, follow along with you and all your adventures.
For sure. Yeah, website is just publiclandtees.com. Kept it simple. And then you can follow along with us at Public Land Tees on basically every platform. Our YouTube channel is Soholt Brothers. Just kicked off a kind of a photography tutorial. There's one going out tonight at 6 about f-stop. So it's right now it's just the boring stuff, but then all the fun in the field stuff will come this spring, summer, and fall. We're doing, Ben O'Brien and I are doing the Roost podcast again this spring, and we'll have dedicated social channels for that. And YouTube series on that, at Roost Show will be our, if anybody wants to go follow along, literally nothing is posted yet on our social channels, but we're getting it all built out. Got a website coming, and we'll do, merch through Public Land Tees for the Roost Show. And obviously do some conservation work with that and raise some money for NWTF or Turkeys for Tomorrow or whoever. This spring. And and if anybody wants to follow my own personal stuff, it's just at Sam Soholt. So
awesome. I love it, dude. Well, man, I appreciate the heck out of your time and just all the knowledge you've been willing to share with all of us. But I look forward to seeing some birds hit the ground with you and old Ben this spring and listening to, you know, that podcast and checking out. I'm especially excited for the rest of that photography video series, man. I'm
for sure.
Bit of a Neanderthal with a camera, but I'm slowly figuring it out. But
yeah, that's what it takes.
Exactly. I appreciate the heck out of your time, man. Thanks for coming on, and shoot, man, good luck this turkey season.
Yeah, thanks. Have a good rest of the spring, and we'll catch up soon.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, XOP, Onyx, Huntworth, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands and support this show, and if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th. U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.